discerninghearts.com, and Spirit Catholic Radio, in cooperation with the Pope Paul VI Institute, presents Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. Dr. Hilgers, after being deeply touched by the teachings of Pope Paul VI's encyclical Humanae Vitae, founded the Pope Paul VI Institute for the Study of Human Reproduction in Omaha, Nebraska. Dr. Hilgers, along with his co-workers, developed the Creighton Model Fertility Care System. He would go on to discover Napro technology. In 1994, Pope John Paul II appointed him to full membership in the Pontifical Academy for Life. And with his wife Susan, Dr. Hilgers serves on the Pontifical Council for the Family. Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. I love these segments of the series because we're talking about positive solutions, about women being healed. And one of the hardest times a woman can go through, one of the most painful, is when a miscarriage occurs and that there are recurrent miscarriages in a woman's life. I know from personal experience, my mother-in-law experienced numerous miscarriages, and it is very, very painful, but one treatment can occur, can it?
Yeah. See, the medical profession, when it comes to a miscarriage, has sort of accepted miscarriage as just a normal process. Mm-hmm. You know, some women miscarry. Nothing you can do about it. And, it is true that there is an underlying miscarriage rate of 10 to 15%, something in that range. But what we've missed is that there's no miscarriage that occurs that's normal. And it's always due to some underlying abnormality. So miscarriage itself is the result of some physiologically abnormal condition. Now, sometimes it only occurs once because it's not a repetitive condition. It just happened in an individual cycle, the mm-hmm. pregnancy, that is. But many times it becomes repetitive. And we still see, even in today's world of gynecology and reproductive medicine, doctors saying to a woman who's had a miscarriage, well, don't worry about it, it's just nature's way. Mm-hmm. Or, she's had two of them in a row, well, don't worry about it. We don't get concerned until you've had three miscarriages. And what you said about the pain that this creates is very real. It's a real sense of loss. It's something that women go through that are very disruptive to their emotions and to sometimes their spiritual life anyway, because they don't know, why is this happening to me? They ask questions like that. They tend to want to blame themselves. And, this idea that, well, it's just normal, don't worry about it, doesn't really go that far at helping them through this. So our approach at the Pope Paul VI Institute has always been, these are not normal events. These are the result of some underlying abnormality. Once again, we don't know all the causes yet, but we do know many of the causes. And so our whole approach is trying to find out what those underlying causes are. And then if we can get to the root cause that we know is related, we can actually have a fair amount, I would say a very fair amount of good success in treating these. And we've had, many, many, many cases over the years of successful pregnancies.
What are some of the causes that would spur on recurrent, spontaneous, essentially abortions, miscarriages?
Yeah, first of all, we have them chart their cycles again using the Creighton Model System. There are really two things that show up on these charts. One is a limited mucus cycle, which is a reduced amount of cervical mucus production. The second is a highly variable, what we call the post-peak phase of the cycle, which is really from the time of ovulation till the beginning of the next menstrual period. Over the years, we've thought that is sort of the stable portion of the cycle that is repetitive from cycle to cycle in terms of its length. But in women who've had miscarriages, there's a lot of variability in the length of that phase of the cycle, and it's because the corpus luteum, which is the little gland in the ovary that produces progesterone, is not working properly. And they don't have an adequate amount of progesterone, and they develop this very unstable post-peak phase. So those two things show up, the post-peak phase meeting the post-ovulatory phase of the cycle. They just show up. They bounce off of these charts that we see. So then if we evaluate them, it's very similar to the evaluation of an infertility patient. We do a thorough hormone profile on them. We do an ultrasound series and a laparoscopy. Now, the laparoscopy is an interesting one because when I'm dealing with medical students and things like that, I'll ask them, what's the incidence of endometriosis in somebody who has multiple miscarriages, for example? And they usually guess, and they guess wrong. And then I ask them, now, where would you find that information? I mean, how could you find out what the incidence is? And they say, well, there must be some study that was published in one of the medical journals or something, da-da-da-da-da. And I say, wrong answer. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing this just to tease them a little bit. But there's a point behind it, because the only place you'll find this actually is in our textbook on medical and surgical naprotechnology. Because many years ago, in trying to work this through, I wasn't always finding causes. I wasn't always finding the thing that seemed to help anyway. Mm-hmm. And so I began doing laparoscopies on these patients. And to my rather significant amazement, I think, I began to find that these women had endometriosis in a very, very, very high percentage of cases. So if you have two or more miscarriages, the incidence of endometriosis is about 85%. So now we know that endometriosis is a cause also of miscarriages. If you have endometriosis and you get pregnant, about 50% of the time you'll miscarry just straight off the top. And that's because endometriosis produces inflammatory toxins, which are in the pelvis. They affect the uterus, tubes, ovaries. They can affect the sperm, the egg, and the early embryo. Mm-hmm. And if you don't correct for those inflammatory toxins, that's also, and it's incidentally the mechanism by which it causes infertility. But if you don't correct for that and get rid of these inflammatory toxins, then you'll continue to have miscarriages. So if we find the underlying hormone problem, if we identify if there's an ovulation-related abnormality and find their endometriosis, and we begin to treat this whole package of problems, we can get 80% successful pregnancy rates, full-term pregnancy rates in this population.
What causes endometriosis?
Well, it's a good question. Endometriosis is a condition where the cells inside the uterus go back through the fallopian tubes and they can get on the bladder, the bowel, the uterus, the ovary, the fallopian tube, different places. And so it's probably a two-part cause, maybe even three parts, because it is genetic. So that's one part. Mm-hmm. The other part is it goes through the fallopian tubes. And then the third part is probably immunologic. The immune system in women who have endometriosis is usually not real strong. And if their immune system were stronger, the immune system would normally get rid of these abnormal cells or cells that are not in the right location. They're abnormal for being in that location. And the body would take care of this on its own, and you wouldn't really have much of a problem with it. But the immune system seems to be suppressed, not very strong in these women who have endometriosis, and so they take up this new home, and they grow and they implant, and they have these little implantation areas, and then they create the inflammatory toxins, and that creates a problem for fertility.
And so the treatment of using a laparoscope, and especially targeting it with a laser, that cleanly takes care of that endometriosis.
Yeah, it gets rid of the endometriosis, and then we presume it gets rid of these inflammatory toxins. Now, these toxins are multiple in nature. And so, unfortunately, you can't take like some of the fluid behind the uterus and just measure what they are. Mm-hmm. And then once you've cleaned up the endometriosis, measure it again to see if they're gone. It's pretty difficult to do that. So it makes it lacks a certain amount of objectivity. So that creates, whenever that happens, there's always a kind of difference of opinion within medical circles. But we're stuck with that for the moment. There's no way we get around that. So all we can do is, this is what we do, this is what our success rates are, and they're generally very good.
We'll return to Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers in just a moment.
Spirit Catholic Radio presents Faith Check. Here's Greg Yule.
Welcome to Faith Check. Many people ask why the church is against birth control if it allows natural family planning to avoid pregnancy. The Catholic teaching that it is a sin to use contraception is nothing new, but the perennial teaching of Judeo-Christian morality. Only in the 1930s did any Christian begin teaching that contraception could be morally acceptable. The sexual union between a husband and wife is a renewal of the wedding vows, which say that I love you freely, totally, faithfully, and fruitfully. To come together in intimacy while deliberately sterilizing the act goes against the intrinsic meaning of intercourse. It says, I love you, but not your fertility. When a couple has discerned that there are serious reasons to avoid a pregnancy, there's nothing sinful about periodic abstinence during the fertile times of the month. Intercourse still remains a renewal of the wedding vows, a total gift of self that is open to the authentic life-giving meaning of sex. Divorce rates among couples using natural family planning are almost non-existent because couples grow in self-control and respect for one another's bodies, which leads to healthier relationships and even more passion and intimacy. This is Greg Ewell for Faith Check.
Mrs. Lucille DiPolito knows about large families. She is the mother of 20 children. And you could not find someone happier about that than she is. Talking with her, you see a wisdom which counteracts the folly of the culture of death. She says, "I said to people, after having a certain number, I'm retired. I got one to do the laundry, one the baking. They rotate their duties." Mrs. DiPolito realized quickly that many members in the family does not mean simply more work to do, but more to do the work. It also means more to give love. As she explains, quote, "When number 19 came, the family gives him love. He got so much love from the family. If he was an only child, he would never have gotten so much love. The mother can only give so much love. When you have a large family, the children are getting all kinds of love from their brothers and sisters. There's nothing more joyful than a baby," end quote. It is not size in itself, of course, that brings virtue to a family. It's how the family members see their relationship with each other and with their daily tasks. The DiPolito family knew the Christian value of work and how work shapes the human person. Mrs. DiPolito told me, quote, "Each child had a responsibility. We butchered our meat, we had a dairy cow. It was a mini farm on 10 acres. A priest friend used to ask us, 'Is there anything in this house that is not homemade?' They made their own butter and altar candles. Some of the talents they have learned from their grandparents. I sew, but now my kids make my clothes for me. I gave to them, but look what I got back." End of quote. This attitude stands in sharp contrast to the give your children all they want mentality, for which Mrs. DiPolito has some strong words. Quote, "No, that's the worst thing you could do. Just providing everything their heart desires, that's absolutely wrong. They need to develop their talents. Doing is learning. They have to be doers. This was the law of the family. By doing, they were learning. By working for something, they respect it. The more you give, there's your happiness. That's what you have to teach your children." End quote. Mrs. DiPolito speaks of the joy she has in her children. Quote, "Watching them grow, seeing the things that they give back, seeing them become good citizens. My daughter is a nurse and has helped bring people back to life. Look at the great joys. You watch them take their first step, say their first word. These are things that money can't buy. The blessings far outweigh the hardships. The world dwells on the hardships. Everything has pain and joy with it. You have to take the bitter with the sweet. We aren't in heaven yet." End of quote. The next time you hear someone say, "Two children are more than enough," pass along the story of Mrs. DiPolito. This is Father Frank Pavone.
This is the Pope Paul VI Institute Minute with Dr. Tom Hilgers.
Giving an armchair tour of the Pope Paul VI Institute. Our National Hormone Laboratory at the National Center for Women's Health helps physicians and medical consultants across the country. We test a whole range of reproductive hormones. Most laboratories only monitor a woman's hormones by the general phase of the cycle, or in pregnancy by its trimester, or by the day of the cycle. An exciting aspect about our standardized hormone testing is that we have reference ranges for every 2 days of a woman's menstrual cycle and for every week during the course of pregnancy. This confirms a woman's Creighton model charting patterns and allows us to diagnose a woman's reproductive cycle and to monitor pregnancies accurately. The National Hormone Laboratory has high quality standards and is a participant in the College of American Pathologists Proficiency Program. The Pope Paul VI Institute is building a culture of life in women's health care. I'm Dr. Tom Hilgers.
For a complimentary gift and more information on the Pope Paul VI Institute, log on to www.popepaulvi6.com.
A prayer to St. Gerard Majella for the respect of life. St. Gerard Majella, Women the world over have adopted you as their patron in the joys and fears of childbearing. Today, we invoke your intercession for the unborn children in our world. Pray that all people will look upon human life as a gift from God, not as an unwanted burden to be destroyed. Assist the efforts of those enlisted in the crusade of promoting the dignity and value of all human life, particularly the unborn. This we ask through Christ our Lord. Amen. We now return to Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. For a woman who has endometriosis, if she is not diagnosed properly or it's not even sought out as a treatment, how would they be treated by a physician who is not aware of that issue?
Well, not very successfully probably would be a good answer. They'll put them on aspirin because they think maybe there's a little bit of a blood clotting problem in the placenta. They'll put them on heparin, which is a blood thinning medication. There's various approaches like that that they'll do. They'll give them a drug called Clomid, which is a fertility stimulating drug. It induces ovulation. Mm-hmm. And they may give them, once they're pregnant, progesterone, because there is the thought that progesterone is low in women who have miscarriages. And if you give them progesterone, you can prevent the miscarriage. But progesterone actually doesn't prevent very many miscarriages, because most of the miscarriages occur because of events that are in place prior to conception or at the time of conception. So until you treat the whole process, the progesterone won't be very, very helpful. But those are things that are done. And they still have their endometriosis, so it's sometimes not very helpful.
But again, that recurrent spontaneous miscarriages, it's not always about endometriosis, correct?
No, not at all. But about 80 or 85% will have endometriosis, so it's a significant component. In fact, it's a good question because it raises this issue of, is infertility or miscarriage the result of just one thing being wrong, or is it a result of multiple things being wrong? And almost universally, it's the result of multiple things not working right. We call it a multifactorial component or aspect to the cause and eventually to the treatment. So if you can find the underlying hormone problems, find the underlying ovulation-related abnormalities and the endometriosis and then anything else that might be related, like low-grade infection, you treat all of those things, you treat them all at once, and then you have a multifactorial or multiple different approaches to treatment. You're correcting all of them at the same time, and then your success rates are going to be a lot better.
It's very intriguing to me, the issue of the limited mucus in the cycle that you can pattern or you can trace through their keeping track of their cycle, and how that could potentially be an indicator that spontaneous abortions could occur. How do you treat that, or how does that play into the whole diagnosis?
Yeah, well, the limited mucus is there because the estrogen levels, which go up just before ovulation, are low. And they're decreased because the follicle, which contains the egg, is not functioning normally. And the egg inside is not normal. So you have a poorly functioning follicle. Sometimes they're quite small even. They rupture, release the egg. The egg's not mature. It's not right to be fertilized. And so you end up with a bad fertilization right from the very beginning. And the limited mucus is, at least in part, due to the low amount of estrogen, the reduced amount of estrogen being produced just before ovulation by the developing follicle. And it shows up on these charts.
I think this leads to an issue that we haven't really explored in the series of talks that we have undertaken. It's about women understanding the importance of tracking that mucus, which is a normal part of our body, and it's a part of what it is to be a female. But yet so many people, for whatever reason, we don't want to, that's just too messy, or I don't want to think about that, or I don't want to know that. Just give me something that will fix me.
Yeah.
And yet we really need to watch that, just like as if any other part of our body, if we have, I can't think of another body part, but I mean, if we didn't track it properly, it should be an indicator there's something wrong with us.
Well, no, it's really important. And Some people talk about the two, the menstrual period and the mucus flow, as a sort of red menstruation and white menstruation, as a way of kind of simplistically looking at it. But the mucus flow, and that's what it is a flow similar in ways to menstruation, has gone completely uninvestigated by the medical profession, except for the work we've done in the Doctors Billings and a few other people in the natural family planning world. But the general medical profession has just totally ignored it. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they don't see the insight that has given to us in all of this. So from a woman's point of view, it's really important to track this. Now, let me give you a few sort of examples. We even doctors sometimes say, oh, women won't do that, or what would you want to, you know, have them do that for? But they wouldn't for a moment prescribe insulin to a diabetic unless that diabetic at home was measuring their and tracking their blood sugar levels.
Good point.
And we're not talking about diabetes here, but in some ways we're talking about even more important conditions. Not that diabetes isn't. I don't want to be misinterpreted on that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of things we do where we ask a patient to track what they're doing. Even if you go to a nutritionist and you want to get on a weight loss program, one of the first things they're going to do is say, well, you keep this diary now and write down everything you're eating for the next week or month or whatever, and then you bring that back and let's look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of things we do we don't pay any attention to. We just accepted it. Nobody argues about it anymore. This is actually easier than all of that. It takes 20 seconds to make this observation. You do it when you're going to the bathroom. It's a natural thing that's easy to do, and in fact, one of its problems in some ways, I often think, is that it's almost too easy. But on the other hand, people come back to us and say, oh, that's got to be so complicated because, you know, how do you teach poor women who are uneducated, or how do you do this, or how do you do that? And I tell my medical students, because it's often the medical student or the doctor who's saying this, the hardest person to teach this to is a doctor married to a nurse, because they have so many preconceived notions about what they think they know. And in fact, they don't really know what it is we're trying to teach them, and they just got to sit back and learn it. And sometimes it can be a real challenge. I'd much sooner take somebody with a first grade education and teach them, because they have no preconceived prejudices or preconceived anything with regard to it, and they're like a sponge. They take it in really well, and they can learn it very easily.
And again, I mean, it is a natural process of what it is to be a female. It is something that we can talk about, and it does amaze me that in our public schools and health classes, we're going to teach our children. I mean, there's proposals to teach them all kind of activities, which some may even consider deviant, and yet, but they need to know. But yet we don't want to talk about this with our daughters to help them to know their bodies. And
right.
I just fascinates me, this thought.
I think there could come a time where there'll be a big push that every woman entering marriage should chart their cycles so that they can see the health of their fertility system. And if some unhealthy thing is showing up, they can actually get treatment before they ever try to get pregnant. So that time, I think, is coming. Now, how soon or how late, I don't know. I may never live to see it, but it makes that much sense in any regard. And, you know, you talk about the health programs. I mean, they'll teach them how to put a condom on a banana, and they'll show them all the different gels and foams and all this other stuff and packets of birth control pills, and they want to show them all these things because, God, they got to know all this. And yet they don't teach them how their body works and functions. You know, what are we really getting done? Really not very much. All we're doing is cultivating a form of sexual behavior, which ultimately can be quite harmful to these young people. And then, of course, we love to, this group of people who promote all this just love to deny that it has any association or linkage, but it doesn't. There's a lot of connection.
And in this particular case, in the subject that we're talking about, for women who are experiencing multiple miscarriages, and they are desperate to know, why is my body doing this? They become a part of the process of discovering exactly what's going on.
Oh, they're very much a partner in all of this. And I think it adds to their own self-confidence about being a participant in their own care. I mean, it's just naturally going to improve the relationship and communication between physician and patient. And like I said before, these patients are some of the best educated that you'll see any place, because they really know and understand how their body works and functions. It's pretty terrific.
And again, it does support, when you go back, the teachings of Humanae Vitae. about the dignity of what it is to be a male and female, and to treat this gift that we've been given with the reverence and the tension that it deserves.
Yeah, well, it does. And it's really completely an outgrowth of Humana Vitae. That's something maybe we haven't emphasized enough, although I know we've said it at the beginning of each of these programs. But if it were not, I often think about this, actually, if it were not for Humana Vitae, if it were not for Pope Paul VI writing that encyclical and having the courage to release it, where would we be? Where would we be? The Catholic Church is the last and only institution in the world that is hanging on to and trying to develop and further promote and evolve a really good view, reasonable view, connected view, integrated view of human sexuality. And if Humanae Vitae would not have been there, it would have been lost. We would never, I don't think, have an opportunity to develop a really balanced, sort of ecologically sensitive almost view of human sexuality. The church, you know, would have just capitulated to all what's happening in our modern society. The further we get away from Humanae Vitae, the further we get into this morass of problems we've seen, the more and more it looks like it's prophetic that Pope Paul VI was a saintly genius, you know.
And again, Humanae Vitae is not a voluminous tome on what it is to be a human. It is about maybe, what, a 20-minute, 25-minute read.
Yeah.
Though I've spent more time just in prayer with each different section. It is absolutely phenomenal, and it's available to anyone who would take the effort to either locate it in a booklet form, or you can find it on the internet.
Yeah, well, they can log on to the Pope Paul VI Institute Minute at thepopepaulvi6.com, and we'll send them a copy.
Well, that was a nice segue.
How about that?
Perfect. Well, Dr. Thomas Hilgers, thank you so much for your time today, and we look forward to the next session.
Great to be here.
You've been listening to Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. To hear and or to download this episode, along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. To learn more about the work of Dr. Hilgers and the Pope Paul VI Institute, go to popepaulvi.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com, Spirit Catholic Radio, and the Pope Paul VI Institute. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join us next time for Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers.